These days,
each decade is a statement
in the age-long global human conversation.
These days, each decade is a statement in the age-long global human conversation. In the cultural message of the 1960s, every American was actively or passively engaged. It so happened that I was most centrally involved in these social changes as member of and shamanic spokesman for a small group of innovative intellectuals who sought to receive and to transmit the emerging cultural signals. The meaning of this explosive decade will be evaluated by history in the light of subsequent developments. It is natural that those who were engaged in the transaction present their versions of what happened and their predictions of the events to come. In January 1960, I accepted an invitation to come to Harvard University to initiate new programs in what was then called behavior change. I was convinced that mental illness could be cured, that drastic limitations on human intellectual and emotional function were caused by inflexible states of mind, static, imprinted, and conditioned neural circuits, which created and preserved artificial and malfunctional states of perceived reality. I believed the nervous system to be a biochemical electrical network capable of receiving and creating a changing series of adaptive realities if and when the chemical key for altering consciousness was found and employed in the context of an adequate theory. In the then zeitgeist of Salk, Fleming, Pauling, I believed that the right chemical used correctly was the cure. The career ailment I had selected as curable was human nature. To oversimplify, I believed that man did not know how to use his head, that the static, repetitive, conditioned circuit known as the normal mind was itself the source of dis-ease, and that the task of the psychologist-neurologist was to discover the neurochemical for changing mind, that is, to allow for new imprints of new realities and new conditioned sequences. Our initial experiments at Harvard suggested that LSD might be such a drug. In the early 60s, we tested these hypotheses in a series of controlled experiments, administering LSD to several hundred persons under the following conditions. The set, or expectation, was for philosophic exploration and self-discovery. The setting was supportive, secure, and respectable. There was not one casualty or bad trip. Our subjects would routinely experience meta-mind intensities and were encouraged to contemplate the personal and social implications of the new signals. The results of these and other psychedelic drug experiences led us to conclude that organic neurochemicals could be used as instruments for studying the nervous system, for freeing brain from the limits of mind, for training human beings to develop new neural circuits, new minds, for reception and transmission. The implications of these conclusions for human freedom could be far-reaching. A new science is defined. I have suggested the term neurologic, the understanding and control of one's own nervous system. More important, a new mythic conception of human nature emerges. The human being is seen as having several minds, defined as neural circuits, which evolve during the course of individual development, and which can be turned on and off selectively and adaptively, as one turns on and tunes the many external electrical circuits with which modern man surrounds himself. In 1960 to 1963, we tested these theories in a series of objective studies of prison rehabilitation, psychedelic psychotherapy, and personality change. The hypotheses were confirmed. We cut the prison return rate by 90%. We demonstrated quantitative psychometric improvement in personality. It was prize-winning, elegant research. Our subjects shared our enthusiasm, but the medical directors didn't. We were naive enough to be surprised that many administrators didn't really want to eliminate the pathologies they administer. God knows they liked me personally, respected our results, and in their secret hearts hoped that we were right. But there is this larval, inertial fear of change. Three times I was offered tenure at Harvard and the post of chief psychologist at Massachusetts General Hospital if I would just play down the drug research. But by then, more than careers were at stake. We had entered the dialogue of myth, tapped into that ancient current of passionate hope and risky belief that mankind can evolve into a higher wisdom. It was the familiar Gnostic, Hermetic, Neoplatonic, alchemical, Faustian, Jeffersonian belief in the individual as microcosm, the all-out vision of multi-centered universe that gives life to individual existence, perennially recurring, always opposed by the Inquisition, always mocked by the current version of cynical, cool-out stoicism. We were thinking far-out history thoughts at Harvard, some 30 graduate students, young professors, and theologians, believing that it was a time after the shallow, nostalgic 50s for far-out visions, knowing that America had run out of philosophy and that a new, empirical, tangible metaphysics was desperately needed, knowing in our hearts that the old mechanical myths had died at Hiroshima, that the past was over, and that the Cold War could not fill the spiritual vacuum. The vision we offered was the head trip, a scientific, experimental, neurologic. Whereas the pre-scientific Oriental philosophies and the Western mystical offshoots speak vaguely of the divinity within each person, we tried to operationally redefine the old teachings and to offer an experimental Neoplatonism. Your brain is the center of your universe. Read any basic text on the nervous system. Learn which of the seven types of drug yoga turns on which circuits of your nervous system. Learn to dial, tune, and focus your time shift. Then you learn to accept total responsibility for the realities you intersect. basis for this new metaphysics was the belief that advances in modern science now make it possible to develop an understanding of the nervous system, its evolution in the individual and the species, and the effects of chemical and electrical adjuvants on its expanding function. And that this understanding of the source and instrument of consciousness is leading us to a truly scientific philosophy of a self-responsible human nature. Educated person in 1960 was familiar with the following scientific concepts, which, if known by the philosophers of antiquity, would certainly have influenced their theories. Number one, the Einsteinian equations concerning relativity and the covariance of space-time. Number two, the nervous system as biocomputer, organized in hierarchical centers, mediating selectively the reception, storage, analysis and transmission of messages. Number three, elementary computer theory. Number four, electrical and electronic technology providing for selectivity of frequency, intensity, and clarity of signal. And number five, the DNA code as source of instructions for constructing, maintaining, and evolving both body and nervous system. With these scientific concepts as suggestive text, and with LSD as instrumental sacrament, and with prayers for grace, we began to write and to talk publicly about the possibilities of a new philosophy, a new individual scientific theology. At this point, 1963, I left Harvard, abandoned the role of conventional academic scientist, and became, without knowing it, a shaman. This shift in occupational role was accomplished slowly, hesitantly, exploringly, and not without self-conscious humor. First, a diligent study of religious history revealed that psychedelic plants had been used in the great philosophy-generating cultures of the past. Egypt, Persia, India, China, and Greece, always for initiation into adulthood, initiation into the spiritual life, and for the training of shamans, prophets, and special priests who played colorful and apparently necessary public ceremonial roles. At the same time, I began personal training in Hindu Vedanta, Buddhist Tantra, and Taoist techniques for understanding the flow of various energies. The obligatory pilgrimage to India occurred. In 1963, we started Centers for Training in Consciousness Expansion, a scientific journal and lecture tours for communicating the results of our research. We were particularly concerned with the development of neurological language of both verbal and, more important, electrical and electronic patterns to communicate the broadened range of consciousness. Our Castalia Foundation in Millbrook, New York, was visited by musicians, electronic sound technicians, painters, and light technicians. The new modes of art we developed, based on the capacity of the nervous system to receive, synthesize, and transmit, accelerate, impress, and multimedia presentations, have since been taken over by commercial film and television people. All of this educational work was enormously successful. Millions of Americans more or less accepted the head philosophy, the belief that ego and social reality are neural fictions, clusters of synaptic connections, consensual paranoias. What might be called a neo-radical nominalism characterized this philosophic revolution, an invisible, implicit, amused, sometimes pious, detachment from reflex social conventions and the fears which they are designed to induce. A general hip rejection of partisan politics, war, violence, military service, racism, white and black, enslaved careerism, erotic hypocrisy, sexism, establishment religion, local orthodoxies of dress, grooming, posture, and art. A rejection, too, of the pomposity of mind, including one's own, and of the platitudinous hippie philosophy itself. This signal of hope and freedom was sent throughout the world. Poets in Soviet prisons heard it, and young people everywhere.
Because the revolution's here, and you know.
The inevitable backlash from this new message of individual power began in 1966, when various legislatures and Congress began considering bills to criminalize LSD and similar drugs. In this year, I testified before two Senate committees urging that control of all mind-changing drugs be assigned to the medical profession, supervised by federal and state health agencies. I predicted that if control of drugs were administered by law enforcement agencies, the result would be a black market more irrational and widespread than that of alcohol prohibition and the growth of enormous police state repressive bureaucracy. And who indeed wanted that? My political position then was by no means radical or solitary. Indeed, during the Johnson administration, a bitter battle was fought on this issue. Medical and scientific people, backed by the Kennedys, urged that drugs be administered by the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, while law and order people politicked for the Department of Justice. History may well decide that the second great belligerent disaster of the Johnson years was the decision to turn drug control over to the police. LSD was made illegal, and most of the top drug scientists began their steady exit from government responsibility. Another war on heresy had been declared.
Timothy Leary is dead.
At this time, the new consciousness became a political issue, indissolubly intertwined with peace, sexual liberation, reform of education, racial equilibrium, ecology, and end the draft. I suppose the political manifestation was inevitable, so I joined the circuit. Peace, love, and free your head, we said. It is my folly to believe deeply in the Jeffersonian vision and the First Amendment. I accept this Merlin heritage, this national trust. Could this first America be saved? Well, we said, if they can make laws, we can repeal them. With the other dissenting spokesmen, I opposed the war and defended marijuana and LSD against unscientific slanders. We warned of the heroin peril and unlicensed, ill-informed drug abuse. I advocated not drugs, no one had to do that, but a rational, philosophic, scientific understanding of drugs. It was the time, can we remember, of civil rights, of non-violent dissent debated openly, registered in the polls, and litigated in the courts. I was followed, set up, and busted like everyone else. Fought test cases, got the federal marijuana law declared unconstitutional. It was in the American tradition to defend what you believed. Every court decision and every poll showed that the new consciousness was growing. The real thing had to do with the way people looked each other in the eye and smiled, knowing that something new and self-responsible was happening in their heads. The world listened. Messages came to us from the dissenting underground in Russia and Brazil. The real revolution of the 60s was neurological.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
The emergence of a new philosophy occurs at rare crossroad points in history. Political, social, and economic changes follow changes in the conceptions of human nature. The consciousness revolution of the 60s challenged every one of the institutions and moral principles upon which our society was based. This systematic questioning of the orthodoxies led inevitably to the Nixon Counter-Reformation, the attempt to reimpose the old authority by means of police power. But the history of inquisitions teaches that cultural philosophic matters cannot successfully be legislated despite heresy trials, sumptuary laws, and former provocateur espionage tactics and secret police. A second classic reaction to the collapse of authority is existential loneliness. Once you have accepted that your nervous system creates from the Heraclitean flow your own reality, what guideposts, what compass readings, what new goals? The divergence, individualism, and utopian optimism of the 60s were crushed by violent reaction. This philosophic vacuum was temporarily filled by a renaissance of old dogmas which have latched on to the new energies: experiential Christianity, homogenized Buddhism, TV Hinduism. These pessimistic, nostalgic creeds have served to turn off, shallow out, calm down the explosive expansions of the last decade. I believe that a new philosophy will be created by those who were born after Hiroshima, which will dramatically change the human condition. It will have the following characteristics. It will be scientific in essence and science fiction in style. It will be based on the expansion of consciousness, understanding, and control of the nervous system, and will produce a quantum leap in intellectual efficiency and emotional equilibrium. Politically, it will stress individualism, decentralization of authority, a live and let live tolerance of difference, local option, and a mind your own business libertarianism. It will continue the trend towards open sexual expression and a more honest, realistic acceptance of both the equality of and the magnetic difference between the sexes. The mythic religious symbol will not be a man on a cross, but a man-woman pair united in higher love communion. It will seek revelation and higher intelligence, not in formal rituals addressed to an anthropomorphic deity, but within natural processes, the nervous system, the genetic code, and without, in attempts to effect extraplanetary communication. It will include practical, technical, neurological, psychological procedures for understanding and managing the intimations of union immortality implicit in the dying process. The emotional tone of the new philosophy will be hedonic, aesthetic, fearless, optimistic, loving. We are now experiencing a quiescent preparatory waiting period. Everyone knows that something is going to happen. The seeds of the 60s have taken root underground. The blossoming is to come. Best wishes, Timothy Leary.